talking about some, I guess, a problem that's not commonly thought about, the strong CP problem, and sort of point out some surprising connections with TV scale colored physics. So the quick outline of the talk is, I'll first remind everyone what's the strong CP problem. I'll go over a few previous solutions and then sort of describe how trying to generalize some of these previous solutions are going to lead to new solutions that have LHC observable signatures. And when I say LHC observable signatures, I mean I'm not going to by hand put in the TEV scale. It's going to be a byproduct, and it'll turn out that there actually be upper bounds on the mass of particles that's going to be in the TEV range. And so sort of independently arriving at the TEV scale. Okay. So what's the strong CP problem? Well, it's actually very easy to understand classically. So if you just open any old textbook, they'll have a picture of the neutron, which is basically a circle that's the neutron, and then three quarks randomly tossed in the middle there. And if you ask a first year what the electric dipole moment is, they can calculate it. It's charge times distance. And so you can see the way I drew it here, there's a dipole moment pointing to the left here. And so if you ask a person classically, what is the dipole moment you expect? Well, you take this picture here, let's say there's some angle theta here, and you just calculate it, right? It's charge times distance. Charge is essentially E. And the distance, you can look up, it's 10 to the minus 4 centimeters for the size of a neutron. And so generically, just looking at your textbook, you'd say, well, I should have a dipole moment that's 10 to the minus 14 charge times centimeters. So what do we actually see? Well, first, let's see how we measure it. So the way we measure the neutron EDM is actually conceptually very simple, experimentally very difficult. We do it via Larmor frequency. So essentially, if you have the electric dipole moment here, it's the same as the spin. So you have it here, and you apply an E or B field to it, then the spin will process around the E or B field. This is just like if you just, classical mechanics, if you take and just spin a top, it'll process around gravity. And so what happens here is that if you can apply an E and a B field. If they're parallel, they add, and if they're anti-parallel, it's the difference between the electric and magnetic dipole moment. And so conceptually, it's very simple, right? You just take a lot of neutrons and spin up. You apply an E field, wait a little time, and see how many have oscillated into a down. Well, yeah. As I said, conceptually, it's simple. Practically, this is an extremely difficult experience. Yeah.
But the previous picture of the previous slide is classical, and it's not what.
Yeah, it's classical, and it's not correct. And but it gives actually roughly the correct order of magnitude estimate.
Sure, yeah.
And so this is how you sort of explain it to without quantum mechanics. And then just like the hydrogen atom, you say that to do it correctly, you need a.
I'm not sure it's correct explanation without quantum mechanics, because then quantum mechanics, you would say, for a neutron at rest, there is only one quantum number to spin. Right?
Yeah.
And another vectorial quantity, an EDM, can only be directed.
Yeah. So sort of the I agree, because sort of the difference between this and, let's say, a water molecule is that this has no rotational degrees of freedom, and we've measured it. And so for H2O, you'd say we know there's a rotational degree of freedom, so you can describe it really like this, but here we don't have it. And so, yeah, this is...
molecules where you have the rotational degrees of freedom, the question is whether... I mean, what EDMs check whether EDM is attached to the
spin,
is
yeah.
Non-zero.
Mm-hmm.
And the classical one always averages to zero, sure. under the rotation.
Yeah. I mean, this is just how you would first explain it to someone who doesn't even know quantum mechanics. And so I think this is sort of the simple picture. you'd say. And I mean, yes, it's not correct, but order of magnitude-ish, it can sort of explain why there's a bit of a problem. Okay, so yeah, some people at Grenoble did this measurement, and what they found was the dipole moment is smaller than 10 to the minus 26 charge times centimeters. And so, sort of for a classical person, the way you would say it is, it's either you have to draw it in a straight line or it's rotating very fast and averages out. And so you would say, in either case, you'd want some dynamical explanation. And so let's go to quantum mechanics and try to look at this a little more accurately. So in quantum mechanics, the way you would phrase this problem is that I have a Lagrangian. I have mass terms here for the quarks. And something that's allowed by all the symmetries of QCD is a term theta here. And if you do a chiral perturbation theory estimate, what you get is that the dipole moment is of order 10 to the minus 16 charge times centimeters times this sort of strange combination here. And so as before, the dipole moment was measured to be smaller than 10 to the minus 26. And so the rough bound on this combination, theta plus the phases of the masses, usually called theta bar, is smaller than 10 to the minus 10. And so this is how you would specify it from a field theory point of view. So why do I have this sort of weird combination here? Well, first, from the QFT point of view, it's even slightly more confusing than the classical point of view, because if you actually look at these phases, these matrices, we've measured all these parameters here. And in particular, we've measured this CP violating phase here, delta, to be fairly large. The way we do this is we look at kaon, the rate at which kaons oscillate into anti-kaons is different with which the rate which anti-kaons oscillate back into kaons. And so looking at that system has basically told us that delta is pretty large. And so it seems strange that this matrix would have these deltas very large, but the sum of the phases on the diagonal here would be small. And another way to say that is that this, any symmetries that would be protecting theta bar to be small are actually broken by this guy delta. Okay. So now, why do we have this combination? So the reason why this combination appears in the EDM is that there exists a symmetry, usually it's an anomalous symmetry since we're also doing things like redefining the mass of the quark, which is that we're sending, if you redefine what you mean by the up quark by a phase, you can counteract this by redefining what the mass term is by a phase and by shifting theta. And so you can sort of see that very clearly here, right? If you rotate UC here, you can compensate it by rotating UYU. And classically, that's all that matters. But then at one loop, there is a quantum correction, and you actually also have to shift theta. And so this is a good symmetry of your theory. And all physical quantities must be invariant to how you sort of describe your system. It shouldn't matter what you call the up quark. And so only the combination here, which is theta plus the phases of these quarks masses, is invariant under the symmetry, which is sort of very easy to see here. And so this is why you sort of have this combination here. Okay, so let's talk about some solutions to the strong CP problem. The sort of easiest to describe are the discrete symmetries, which is we can use, if parity or charge times parity was a good symmetry of nature, it would set the neutron EDM to zero. And so, well, you can ask to set one of them to be a good symmetry. And so actually, the fact that P and CP set the neutron EDM to zero is very easy to see class. What you can just do is sort of do it pictorially. So what I've done here is drawn a neutron whose spin and dipole moment are parallel. And I'm just going to ask what happens under parity. So parity is just x goes to minus x. And so it's very easy to see that the dipole moment, which is proportional to the vector position, just changes sign. Meanwhile, the spin is a cross product between r and p. And so as you send x to minus x, it doesn't actually change. And so what parity does is that it sends a neutron whose spin and dipole moment are parallel to a neutron whose spin and dipole moment are anti-parallel. And so we've measured the neutron, and we know there's only one neutron. And so if this is to be a symmetry of the nature, that means one of these two vectors has to vanish. And so we know spin is non-zero. So if parity was a good symmetry of nature, the dipole moment would vanish, and that would be that. The other one is CP, or equivalently time reversal. And so again, we can do the same thing of considering a neutron whose spin and dipole moment are parallel. And so again, the dipole moment is something static, and so it doesn't change under time reversal. But spin changes sign because the momentum here changes sign. And so again, it takes a neutron whose spin and dipole moment are parallel to one which is anti-parallel. So requiring it to be a good symmetry of nature means that the dipole moment must vanish. Okay, so the approach to using these guys is basically as follows. You say you require one of these two guys to be a good symmetry of nature, and then you need to spontaneously break this symmetry because in the IR, neither one is actually a good symmetry of nature. So you have to spontaneously break it while arranging for the CKM phase to be large and the neutron EDM to be small. And so if you use parity, they're just called parity-based models. If you use CP, they tend to be called Nelson-Barr models. And yeah, so that's this approach. The next solution I'm going to talk about is the axion solution. And this is essentially everyone's favorite solution to the strong CP problem. It's sort of everyone's favorite solution because it's extremely, extremely minimal. What you do is you take the standard model and you add one new field, A, and you add one new coupling, which is A over F to GG tilde. And this solves the strong CP problem. So the way it does it is that using chiral perturbation theory, you can take this coupling here and calculate V of A, and you discover that it's sinusoidal and that its minimum is at exactly theta bar times FA. So in particular, when you do your calculation for the neutron EDM, you discover that it's proportional to theta bar minus A over F, and so it actually vanishes at the minimum. And so what this does is A here basically sets theta bar to zero, and then everyone's happy because you've solved the set the neutron EDM to zero. Not only that, but it's very nice because it's a very good dark matter candidate. If you choose FA correctly, then its number abundance can be exactly that of dark matter. It's actually, if you care about UV motivations, it's fairly motivated by string theory because string theory just sort of spits out axions left and right. And so one of them could very easily be the axion that solves the strong CP problem. And so I guess I'm not going to tell you too much more about that since we have local experts here who can tell you in much more detail than myself. And so let's sort of move on to new solutions. And to sort of motivate the new solution I'm going to be talking about first, I'm going to talk about the very last sort of popular-ish solution, which was the massless up quark. And so the massless up quark was proposed a good 40 years ago, and its idea is extremely simple. It's if the up quark mass is zero, then you have this anomalous symmetry. And you'll notice that because I don't have the up quark Yukawa anymore, there is no invariant under this symmetry. And so there's basically no invariant to construct the neutron EDM out of, and so the neutron EDM must vanish. Equivalently, you can just calculate in chiral perturbation theory the estimate and show that it's proportional to the reduced mass of the up quark and the down quark, but it's easier to see just conceptually. And so I guess one other thing I want to sort of emphasize a bit about the massless up quark solution is that it's how it works in the IR. And so in the UV, you say something like, well, there's a massless quark. I can rotate theta to zero, and that's that. But you could also choose not to rotate theta to zero. And so what happens then is then QCD confines, it spontaneously breaks this anomalous U1 symmetry. And so, well, as should be very familiar, there's should be an axion out of this. This is usually called the eta prime boson. And so in the IR after confinement, if you have not rotated away theta, the eta prime boson takes care of that for you. This is exact in the limit of large NC. It's QCD is not exactly large NC, so it's not exactly this, but morally similar. And so it's a very nice solution because it's literally no new physics to solve all our problems. But if you look at a lot of lattice papers, you'll find that the mass of the up quark is significantly non-zero. And so what people typically will say is that the massless up quark solution is strongly disfavored. And so it appears that the massless up quark solution is not viable. But
yeah.
That's right. Yeah, so like if you just write in Kao perturbation theories, second order terms in M squared, you discover that the sum rules you use to see if the up quark mass vanishes are now non-zero. And you just have to look at lattice calculations to see if that's the reason why.
They have a very reflective argument, but the thing
it's
is...
Not, yeah, it's not...
No,
yeah.
The thing is that you can mimic the transformation properties of upward mass mode.
Yeah.
So that's writing some...
Additional
terms,
yeah. It's basically, yeah, the higher order m squared terms give things that look like mu that are proportional to md plus ms. And it's really, at that point, you just have to say, we have to go to a lattice and ask our lattice friends, what do they say about this size of things like terms like that? And so I'm not an expert, but so I just take things at work. Face value, which is sort of why I said it's not ruled out. I just say strongly disfavored because I don't quite understand all the systematic errors and everything that goes into lattice calculations. But if at face value, they say things like it's ruled out at 10 sigma. Okay, so it's been basically 40 years since the massless up quark came about. It was sort of in a bad shape when it first arrived, and now it's essentially dead. And so as a sort of good model builder, the first thought should be, let's try to find the simplest generalization of the massless up quark solution. And that's basically what I'm going to talk about now and show that it actually ends up leading to TV scale physics. What I mean here is first, since the massless up quark solution is ruled out, I have to actually define what do I mean by the massless up quark solution. And so what I mean is that if you just take your theory, you look in the UV and say you have a massless quark, there's a sector which confines that removes this massless quark from the IR degrees of freedom. And after confinement, the eta prime boson is important in solving theta and setting our theta to zero. And so let's just sort of see what's the minimal extension to the standard model which does this. So all of our quarks are massive, so it's very easy. What we have to do is pretty obvious. Just add two new quarks that are massless. Of course, this is experimentally excluded, and so they cannot be removed from the IR by the confinement of SU3 color. So there has to be another sector here, SUN, with its own theta angle, which confines and removes BB bar. And now we have to ask, how does the eta prime boson here act? What does it do? Well, a very simple calculation, or you can just do an anomalous rotation, is to show that it sets our theta angle here to be theta bar minus sort of n over 3 times their theta angle. And so if I want to solve the strong CP problem, I need their theta angle to be exactly this combination of 3 over n times theta plus the phases. And so at this point, I have not solved the strong CP problem. I've simply pushed it into why is the theta angle of this other sector this weird number, right? It'd be very strange. And so you might just stop here and say, let's give up. But we actually know of a gauge group which has exactly this theta angle, which is QCD. So for QCD, n equals 3, and its theta angle is just this sum. And so if we want this guy to work, is we need an exact copy of QCD over here. And so what that means, well, so aside from that, that means we can't just copy QCD. We have to start copying quarks and Yukawa couplings. And so what's the minimal amount of things to copy? Well, we have to copy leptons because of anomaly cancellation. We know QCD spontaneously breaks SU2, and from current measurements, it seems like we're not living in a technicolor theory, and so what we need to do is then copy SU2 on the other side, and hence the Higgs boson. And so basically, we need to copy everything except for the U1 gauge boson. So let's see, this is essentially the model that you arrive at, which is that you have a standard model, a copy of the standard model, with the Z2 symmetry relating the two, so that all their couplings, all their Yukawas, theta angles, and everything are exactly equal. And then you add to this guy here a bifundamental BB bar of SU3. And yeah.
If you don't call the U1, how do you match the degrees of freedom in this, quarks because of the charges, more degrees of freedom?
Well, if you don't copy the U1, you just say it goes to itself under the Z2. They have their own SU2s, so we basically share an E and M.
Okay.
And that's
share.
It. We don't share SU2s, we don't share SU3s, but we share an E and M. And yeah, they're going to be cosmology issues that I'll talk about later, but yeah, for now.
Generation? You're taking generations on the
Yeah, so there's going to be 3 generations here, 3 generations here.
So that's not dictated by anomaly constellation anymore because you don't have any U1s, right? So this is because of Z2 symmetry?
Yeah, that's because of the Z2 symmetry. And we essentially need to copy all 3 generations because the theta angle depends only on sort of the phases of the masses. It doesn't actually depend on the magnitude. So the top quark is just as important to the strong CP problem as the up quark or the down quark or any other quark. And so there's really nothing that differentiates the generations for the strong CP problem. So you just have to copy all 3 of them.
In the end of the day, the way I understood the massless solution was that in the end of the day, you have a symmetry which whose only effect is the anomaly and that will even rotate theta to 0.
Yeah.
So what's the symmetry?
And so, yeah, so that's here the anomalous symmetry is you have the massless quarks BB bar. And so let's say we rotate them. What happens is we change both theta angles here by the exact same amount. And so what we do is, which that means is that the sum of these 2 theta angles is unphysical, but the difference is still physical. But because of the Z2 symmetry, the difference is 0. And so these massless quarks set both of our theta angles to 0 at the same time. And so this is how it works just at this toy model level, is that it's the massless up quark solution that solves it for both of us at the same time.
It's more similar to left right.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, where you would say that the right hand is forming the same structure as left hand.
Yeah.
You have a mirror symmetry and the way you call it automatically permission matrices.
Yes. Yeah, so I'm actually, that's going to be the second model I'll talk about after that, is a parity based model. And so I'll leave more detailed discussions of those later. And so sort of this is the model, right? Two standard models, a copy with a bifundamental. What are the constraints? Well, we don't see a mirror sector, right? So what that means is that the mirror sector must be a lot more massive than us. right? Their Higgs VEV must be much larger than ours. And so just to sort of give an idea of what happens, let's set their Higgs VEV. For now, it's arbitrary. I'll try to motivate numbers later to 10 to the 14 GeV and just ask what happens as a function of RG scale as you go from high energy to low energies. So as a quick plot, I have the RG scale down on the bottom and the QCD coupling here. And so at high energies, way up here, we have the two standard models with their Z2 symmetry, a massless quark. We say we can rotate, use an anomalous rotation on the BB bar and set both theta angles to zero at the same time. That's all nice and good. And then so then you just RG evolve down to 10 to the 14 GeV. And then at that point, their standard model becomes different than ours. And so in particular, all of their quarks, all of their leptons, their neutrinos, everything become massive, and we can integrate them out. And then at low energies, all that remains is their SU3. And again, at this stage, all we have is our standard model, their SU3 with a pair of bifundamentals. And again, because of the structure that was in their standard model, their theta angle and our theta angle are the same. And so again, we can continue to use an anomalous rotation that sets both to zero at the same time. And then eventually, because now the matter content is different, their QCD becomes stronger first, and it confines. For this choice of parameters, it turns out that's near the TeV scale, but that's not important for conceptually. And then once that happens, these guys confine, it removes your massless quarks from the IR, and then you just have the standard model at low energies with a theta angle that's zero.
What is the
fine
structure you get from
BB
bar confinement? Do you
Mass fine structure? So the mass, I'll talk about it in more detail later, but what you get is you have SU3 confining with three flavors, and so you get you have SU3 left times SU3 right broken down to the diagonal, and so you get 8 massless pions.
Yeah.
And then you discover that this symmetry is actually already explicitly broken by the fact that you gauged SU3 color. And so they're massless at tree level, they get a one loop correction to their mass from the gluons. And so that gives them a large mass. This is actually completely analogous to pi plus pi minus. So pi plus pi minus, the reason why they're split is there's a one loop divergence due to E and M that's cut off by the rho meson. And so here, this is SU3 with three flavors. So you can actually directly just generalize, scale up QCD. And you say that these guys will have rho mesons, which will cut off the quadratic divergence that comes about from the one loop gluon loop.
So that means they run down from the TeV.
Yes, that's right. Times weak scale and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I said TeV, but this is really a few TeV and whatnot.
Okay.
And so I'll go into the more details about their mass in a little bit.
Can I form a baryonic or something?
Yeah, so if you look at their baryons, let's say like B cubed, you can choose how to deal with our SU3 indices in a way that it still has color. So yes, the baryons of their sector will have color under us. And so when I say sort of, the only reason I talk about the pions first is because they're the lightest things.
Are the baryons stable?
The way I wrote them right now, yes.
Yeah.
There's a U1 that acts on B here. And so it's gonna be cosmology issues and whatnot, but. Well, it's not entirely clear. I remember there was a lot of controversy over like our hadron type objects.
You can join U1 and then with the other guys.
Yeah.
So you just have a common U1 between the two?
Mm-hmm.
So
and even then it's not
photon.
Really...
There's only one photon?
Yes. I mean, even then it's not necessary to have only one photon. But...
Well, yeah, but it makes it...
It's nice for things like end effective and whatnot.
Yes.
So
why can't I say that I like this model better? I integrated all the other stuff you've got going on in high scale and say, here's a much more economical model.
Yes.
And in this model, there's no Z2 symmetry anymore. So how do I understand that?
So this is a very remarkable point about the standard model, which is that RG effects on theta are minuscule. And so actually, the standard model theta angle only starts RG running at 7 loops. And so basically, I can completely neglect the RG running, which is, and so even though I had the Z2 and the UV, which is badly broken, and so now the RG, these guys will now no longer be equal due to RG differences. It's just, in the standard model, it's really small. And so the way to see why it's so small in the standard model is you say, the only other source of CP violation is the CKM matrix. And so what I want to do is, I have to say the RG evolution of theta depends on the Yukawa matrices in such a way that it has a complex number. And so if you just say, I want to write down a product of Yukawa matrices, which has a which is complex, but still respects all the SU3 flavor symmetries, you discover that you need to write down 16 products of Yukawas, right? To zero authority, you just say YU times YU dagger, that has none, and then you go dot, dot, dot.
That same statement would be that supposing I just have nobody at low energies except for the standard model, but I arrange it so that when I match to the low energy theory theta is zero,
yes,
then you're telling me I don't have a strong CP product.
That's right. That's, for example, how a lot of the, let's say, the Nelson bar approach works. They say CP is a good symmetry in the UV. It's broken, so then theta can be regenerated. But because at low energies, the RG evolution is very small, it stays solved. And so, in practice, those models turn out to be pretty difficult to suppress the contributions in the UV scale. But at low energies, it's the same, yes. Yeah. And so here I was motivated simply by generalizing the massless up quark solution. And we'll see other interesting things that come about due to that. But yeah. Okay. And so solutions to the strong CP problem are very highly constrained by higher dimensional operators. In this case, you can write one, which is basically HH dagger times GG tilde, and it's Z2 conjugate. So this is, this respects the Z2 symmetry. And what this does is that once theta, the two Higgs vevs are non-equal, it sets the difference in the theta angles to be non-zero. And so due to experimental constraints, this needs to be smaller than 10 to the minus 10, which means that the scale of the mirror sector here has to be smaller than 10 to the 14 GeV. So this is sort of why I chose in this plot here, 10 to the 14 GeV. Yeah, I'll have a plot that does that. But it's a logarithmic dependence, right? It's dimensional transmutation. And so as you vary this by orders of magnitude, you don't change the TEV scale by orders of magnitude. You just change it by a factors of few. OK. And so I'd said this has LHC observable signatures. And the observable signatures come from the pseudo-Goldstone bosons here. So in particular, the pions we mentioned earlier. And so the pions, right, come about from an SU3 left times SU3 right broken down to the diagonal. So that's a scalar color octet. And they get a one-loop mass from the gauge from the gluon loops, which are cut off by the rho meson. And so we can literally just take what we do for the pi plus pi minus, generalize it to this case, and then rescale everything to a higher scale. And so you can basically make a plot here, which is essentially the mass of these scalar octets as a function of the H prime. Or equivalently, this is as a function of what theta bar is equal to. And so we have a bound, which from theta bar being smaller than 10 to the minus 10, says that the mass of these new scalar color octets has to be smaller than about 2 TeV or so. And so this is well in the range of LHC. In particular, if the LHC could reach exclusions of 2 TeV, it would be able to exclude this model. These would decay through the anomaly into a pair of gluons.
Yeah, so
and so it's there. Are,
for
yes. So there are searches for diejet resonances. Those right now don't have any sensitivity because this is a one-loop suppressed process. And so it's doesn't have, they don't quite have the cross-section yet. And so they're actually more sensitive right now to pair production. Right, because this is a one loop suppressed, and so when you take the amplitude, like the production cross section, it's 1/amplitude squared or 1/loop squared.
What would be, are there any sort of estimates of what the masses of this tower?
So then you would say absolutely there's actually no constraint at all. I'll get to it in a little bit, actually, that actually if you, even without, then the let's see, then if you start at near the Planck scale, the confinement scale starts reaching things like 10 TeV or 100 TeV, and so it's not quite observable. I'll actually motivate 10 to the 14 without looking at Planck scale physics later, but yeah. Okay, so right at the current luminosities and energies, the LHC would be sensitive to is pair production of these guys because it's an unsuppressed cross section, and so we're looking at 4 gluons with 2 resonances. Currently the best search I know of is by CMS, and what they were doing is looking for RPV top squarks. But in practice, what they were looking for is four jet events with no missing energy and a pair of resonances with the same mass. And the way you look at these plots is you have some cross-section for new physics as a function of its mass, and everything below this black line is excluded, or sorry, above this black line is excluded, and everything under it is allowed. And so what you do is, to zeroth order, there's obviously a fair number of uncertainties here, you can just plot your cross-section over on top of this, and you see that the current bounds is something like 500-ish. Of course, I'm glossing over a lot of important details, but it's around 500. And so we still have a lot of ways to go between 500 GeV and 2 TeV, but it's sort of interesting that you are looking for something that's not what you might have thought is the most important thing due to naturalness. Okay, so now let's just very briefly talk about the hierarchy problem, which is what I've essentially done is I've right now traded the strong CP problem for a hierarchy problem. We have the 10 to the 2 GeV Higgs, the standard model hierarchy problem. We're not going to say anything else about it, but I've introduced the mirror sector has a Higgs VeV around 10 to the 14 GeV, and so there's a hierarchy between it and the Planck scale, which is exactly 10 to the minus, or 10 to the 10. And so I've literally just traded the hierarchy problems. But in some sense, it's better because we have a lot of solutions to the hierarchy problems. So we have SUSY, we have Technicolor and whatnot that could implement, go at this scale.
Yeah, but how do you marry them with the fact that the other sector has 10 to the 14 GeV Higgs VeV while our sector has much lower value.
Yeah, so then if you try to do something like that, what you'd only solve is the hierarchy problem for the 10 to the 14 GeV, not the standard model hierarchy problem. And not only that, but remember what I mentioned earlier was that the RG running of the standard model is very small. And when you do things like supersymmetrize it or technicolorize it, it typically destroys this feature and it starts running very quickly. And so it's a general feature. This is sort of part of the reason why sort of the CP approach I mentioned earlier is not that popular, is because it's so fragile. It's very easy to break.
What if you had minimal flavor violations, so all your CP violation comes with the same step, you know, the column matrix?
Yeah, so if you use MFV, then it's okay because the only source of CP violation are the Yukawas, and so the same argument before of needing many, many products of the Yukawas holds.
Right.
You add a lot more new particles who don't necessarily transform under SU3, and so MFV is not always applicable in those situations. It's true for the minimal SUSY cases, but not necessarily the more general case. And so what I'm going to argue about is actually, though what I wrote down right now actually does not have a hierarchy problem worse than the standard model, despite the fact that it looks like we do, right? Because we have two scales, both of which are below the Planck scale. So it looks like we have two hierarchy problems, but in reality, we only have one. And so the approach I'm basically going to say is, I'm going to be agnostic about how 10 to the 2 GeV Higgs is solved. And just say, for some reason, the Higgs mass is very small. But if you look at the, and now we look at the quartic. If you notice, because what I've done is I've changed the standard model, the RG running of the quartic, just by adding a 3-3 bar of colored fundamentals. And so when you calculate what the effect on the running of the quartic, you discover that the standard model Higgs actually has a second minimum around 10 to the 14 GeV. And so what you can do is literally say that I have an exactly Z2 symmetric world. Both of the, for some reason, the Higgs mass in both sectors is small. This is one fine-tuning because of the Z2. And the only difference between our sector and their sector is that we happen to live in the minimum near the origin, and they happen to live in the other minimum at 10 to the 14 GeV. And so this is literally just dimensional transmutation, right? Because it's RG running of the quartic. And so there's no associated hierarchy problem with this guy. And so this is another way to motivate 10 to the 14 GeV that has no, that without referring at all to the Planck scale physics. And so it's sort of an amusing thing that there is a self-consistent solution here where we basically just have them sitting at 10 to the 14. Notice that I cannot choose any number other than 10 to the 14 GeV here at this point, because it's completely dictated by dimensional transmutation. And so there's, if you take this approach, there's literally only one data point you need to be concerned about, which is with when their Higgs-Vev is at 10 to the 14 GeV, which means that the scalar color octet sits at 2 TeV, the theta angle sits at, well, depending on how seriously you take 1 over n Planck suppressed operators, it would sit at a maximum of about 10 to the minus 10. And so it's sort of, you have two approaches to try to test this thing or equivalently confirm it. Okay. So yeah, this is sort of an amusing fact.
Since you raised Planck suppressed operators, that makes it sound like if you really thought there were Planck suppressed operators, it might cause a problem.
So the point is, if you choose 10 to the 14 GeV, it happened to sit exactly at 10 to the minus 10, which is at current bounds. And so if you wanted to test this model, what you would want to do is then, and you took Planck suppressed operator seriously, you'd want to design a slightly better neutron EDM experiment to measure a theta of around 10 to the minus 10. And you'd want to see the LHC to see new particles at 2 TeV, because the masses of these new particles and the theta angle are correlated.
And there are issues whether you write 1/4 pi and
1/4 and so there's going to be, there's when you write 1/4 n Planck suppressed operators, there's inherent slop of what's the coefficient. And so it's, yeah, there's some amount of wiggle room there. Yes, sure.
So if I extrapolated the cross section for pair production, you wouldn't even see these 100 dB collider, right?
Yeah, so then I think once you start getting higher luminosities and better control, you might hope to see it in like dijet resonances. But yeah, it's not entirely, I don't think the LHC will not be able to reach 2 TeV, unfortunately. But it's always nice to have a goal. Especially since it's nice in the sense that it's not like Suzy, where you can just say, I could just keep on pushing it a little bit heavier, a little bit heavier, a little bit heavier. Here, there's basically one data point that's sort of self-consistent here. And at least the minimal implementation. Of course, you can always be like, start deforming things a little bit to try to move things around. Yeah, exactly. You always write the minimal thing first, and then when it's excluded, you go, whoops, go back, I'm going to write some extra operator.
Yeah, So whatever you do, there will be some surviving cosmological fraction of these particles that are stable, right?
So cosmology.
They don't have to, right? It depends on what scale you reheat.
If you reheat to, let's say, TeV, you're fine. But if it's over a TeV, like when you start getting to like the masses of their baryons and whatnot, then you start having issues.
They're colored.
They're colored, and so, I mean, it's sort of like our hadrons. There's some argument over what's the correct relic abundance calculation to do of stable colored particles, and so.
Whatever the abundance is, if they are not, right? They will make their way into the nuclei.
But you still need to solve the 10 to the 14 GeV hierarchy problem always, right? You need to have something that comes in there. Because you don't want to. See, I asked this yesterday and I'm still confused about it. So when you expand around that vacuum of 10 to the 14 GeV, there is a large Z2 breaking, right? Compared to the when I expand around that vacuum. So that doesn't fit in at all?
It does, but all it does is it changes our Higgs boson mass, right? And that's the hierarchy problem that I'm not solving. Which
doesn't affect anything in the theta or...
It doesn't affect theta because of the argument I've said before of just, if you literally just say, like, you have to construct a product of Yukawa's.
Always remain massless, it's fair, so there's always a symmetry.
And so inherent in this approach I just said here is not solving the 10 to the 2 GeV. So that means you have to say any of the more recent things like, well, you can say either the multiverse, you could say anything like the relaxion or n-naturalness, anything where the Higgs looks like it's fine-tuned. Well, I mean, you could make it much lower. And then the bound was around 500 GeV. And so you see here that you can make it, push it down to maybe like 10 to the 2 G, 12 GeV or something. But yeah. Again, this is only if you look at our 1 over M Planck suppressed operators. If you decide not to look at them, then you can just set it anywhere above 10 to the 12 GeV. Okay, so this is sort of amusing that what I was trying to do is sort of do what any good model builder wants to do, is you take a really simple solution to the strong CP problem, it got excluded, try to find the simplest generalization, and by chance it happens to have sort of interesting, predict interesting new particles at the LHC with a very concrete sort of upper bound or for the mass. And so that's kind of nice, but are there any other sort of ways of connecting LHC observable physics to the strong CP problem? And the answer is actually yes. And to do that, I'm going to talk about in more detail about parity-based solutions to the strong CP problem. And in particular, I'm going to talk about a model that was proposed a very long time ago by Barchang and Sanyanovic. Which is a parity-based solution, and it actually turns out to predict TeV scale physics as well. And so the way you do that is, so you say you have parity, which is, under parity, you say SU3 and U1 go to itself, and you have an SU3 weak and an SU3 weak prime that are exchanged under parity. And so in their model of parity, what they did is they just doubled all the matter content here, the fermions, and the Higgs. And so parity sets one to the other. And remember, parity acts non-trivially on space-time indices. In particular, it takes fermions to anti-fermions. This is part of sending left-handed particles to right-handed particles. And so what this does is that it sends our Yukawa couplings to the complex conjugate of their Yukawa couplings. And so what this means is that their Yukawas are equal to R starred. And in particular, notice that the Ys here can still be complex. And so you can still have a very large CKM angle. And not only that, but you could also have arg det y be non-zero. And so the CKM phase, and yeah. Okay. So now let's ask, what is theta bar? Well, theta bar is equal to theta plus the phases of the masses. And because of parity, these yu and yu primes are related by complex conjugations. So these two guys cancel exactly. And then the theta angle vanishes because it's just theta gg tilde, and gg tilde is odd under parity. And so what this does is, this is a parity-based model that sets theta bar equal to 0. And so this is nice. It's a solution to the strong CP problem. But again, as before, we have not observed mirror particles. And so the mirror particles must be heavy. And so like before, let's just set the mirror Higgs to be have a large VEV. And so the way they propose doing that is just you introduce a new pseudoscalar that's odd under parity and give it an expectation value. This guy can couple to, let's say, a phi h dagger h coupling. Then after it gets a mass, or a VEV, sorry, it gives the two Higgs VEVs different mass, or two Higgs's different masses. And so, again, testability here will be considered, will be come about from looking at 1 over m Planck suppressed operators. And so, again, this is one that you can write that's consistent with parity, which is phi here is, which is odd under parity. GG tilde is odd under parity, so you can write this guy down. And after phi here gets a VEV, it sets the theta angle non-zero. And so you need phi over m Planck to be smaller than 10 to the minus 10. And so to connect this with the masses of particles in the other sector, what I'm going to do is just say, I'm going to render this theory natural, solve the hierarchy problem here at 10 to the 9 GeV with something, let's say, SUSY. And what it does is it, right, it solves the hierarchy problem. So it means all the masses of all scalars should be around 10 to the 9 GeV. But for some reason or another, our Higgs is lighter than this. It's fine-tuned for some reason. I'm not going to solve the standard model Higgs hierarchy problem. I'm just going to solve this 10 to the 9 hierarchy. And so what solving the 10 to the 9 hierarchy does is it just sets the H prime VEV and phi to be about the same. And so what that means is when you multiply by the up quark Yukawa, that the mass of the mirror up quark here has a mass smaller than 10 TeV or so. And so what this does is it says there should be new colored particles observable at the LHC, and their mass ratios are equal to the standard model mass ratios. So we know the masses of the up quark and the down quark. We should see two new particles with mass ratios exactly equal to that. And so to sort of specify how we see them, we have to specify how they decay. And how they decay is related to a term you can or you might want to write here, which is a mixing term between their right-handed quarks and our right-handed quarks. And so this mixing is allowed by the symmetries. It's technically natural to keep it small because it's an explicit breaking of the mirror baryon number. This is a 3x3 matrix. It can introduce new FCNCs. So if it's completely random, it needs to be smaller than about 100 GeV. Or it could just be diagonal because we don't understand flavor yet. So let's see what happens in the various cases. So if m was 0, then we have stable fourth generation particles because there's a conserved mirror baryon number. And so this is just a pair producing some R hadron type search. The current bounds are about a TeV or so. If M is a random matrix, then the way it decays is it mixes with our right-handed quarks. Our right-handed quarks can only decay through the Yukawa couplings. And so it then decays, and because the Yukawa couplings are very hierarchical, it prefers greatly to decay into the top. And so what it does is just something that looks like a fourth generation, any typical fourth generation, right? It's a new heavy particle that decays into the third generation. If M is diagonal, then what happens is it can only mix with the lightest guy in their sector is a mirror up quark. It can only mix with our mirror up quark. And so it decays then into the first generation plus the Higgses. And so what you might look at for is just pair production of these guys. If the masses are diagonal, you basically just get two gauge bosons or Higgses and two light quark jets. And so it's sort of amusing that in this case, it's sort of the exact opposite of the current intuition, which is that any fourth generation quarks should decay into the third generation first. But okay. There's no real dedicated search, and so the bounds on these guys are a little unclear. So very quickly, the branching ratios very quickly go to 2:1:1, as to be expected from the Goldstone boson equivalence theorem. And so when looking for these guys, you don't even need to scan over the branching ratios. You should just take 2:1:1. So the cosmology in these sectors are kind of amusing. You can't go to reheat above 10^9 GeV. This is the scale of spontaneous breaking of parity because of domain walls. That would overclose the universe, and that's excluded. So if these guys were stable, if the masses were zero, then you have to reheat smaller than the masses of these new quarks, because they would then, you'd produce new stable colored particles. You'd have issues with overclosing the universe. You'd have issues with heavy seawater, et cetera, et cetera. If M is not equal to zero, you just have to say, as long as they decay before BBN, you're good. An amusing thing is that the mirror sector actually happens to have a first order phase transition. And so if you wanted to do electroweak baryogenesis, it's naturally first order already. You just need to get the CP violation. And then if you wanted to do that, you just need to make sure that the mirror quarks decay into us after phalerons are frozen out. Otherwise, the B plus L asymmetry will get wiped out again. CP violation, yeah. It would need to be at the scale 10^9 where the breaking is. And so we have no real constraint. We don't really have very strong constraints on CP violation at 10^9 GV. And so that's OK.
When you say electroweak baryogenesis, that's
not a manifestation of that CP violation. No, because it's a mirror sector, it also has its own mirror electroweak phase transition. And so I'm just saying that the mirror electroweak phase transition is first order, and so it's easier to do electroweak baryogenesis in the mirror sector. Yeah, that's right. But again, like before, it only does creates a B plus L asymmetry, and so it'll be wiped out by phalerons, so you need them to decay to us after phalerons have frozen out. Yeah, and so I mean, if you do that quick estimate, you find all those signals would be displaced vertices or long-lived particles in that case. Okay, so to conclude, it's amusing that there are solutions to the strong CP problem that are sort of testable at sort of colliders, low energy colliders. It's usually something you only think about for the hierarchy problem or dark matter. But it really shouldn't surprise us too much, since in some sense, all the original solutions to the strong CP problem were testable at low energies. I talked about two solutions. One was sort of, I tried to generalize the massless up quark solution. And by literally following my nose, trying to write down the simplest generalization I could, you find that you should be looking for a four jet search with two resonances. It should be something at 2 TeV or less. By looking more carefully at a previously proposed parity-based solution, you see that we should be looking at fourth generation quarks. Well, we already are, but it sort of makes you look a little more carefully at fourth generation quarks that sort of preferentially decay into either the first generation or the third generation quarks. Okay, thanks.
So about 10 years ago, Gibbs and I was playing with various higher form fields, the formulation of strong CP, and there, the strong CP appeared as a problem of arbitrary web of these fields, right? So in his logic, it would be none of this, like, some higher parity is the solution to this problem at all, because theta would be like an hour of spontaneous breaking, and it would be order one, right, at all times. Did you have a look at those?
I'm actually not that familiar with those papers.
Yeah.
I haven't looked at them.
So I think it's an equivalent reformulation of Strong's P, but his point was that theta is in itself is like a spontaneous breaking. So in that sense, the symmetry argument initially setting theta to zero.
Well, I mean, yeah, we usually just say like, you either say there's a symmetry of the theory or there isn't, and you don't really.
Right.
Yeah.
But if you can have a symmetry, but the ground state would break it. Right? So
yeah,
in,
that's right.
In
yeah.
his point, there was that the theta not equal to zero is the ground state of the theory that is, you know, breaking. So it's strong.
Yeah, I've looked at them, I
don't
remember
them. No, but that's the outcome of this from his papers is that Nelson bar and whatever is not really a solution. That, that's one of the claims that he makes, okay?
Yeah.
So that,
yeah, but I'll tell you, there is this paper by Presley that says you can have strong CP symmetry come out of as a discrete gauge symmetry. So in the UV, you can just write it down and say that I have nothing. Yes, and the vacuum will break it because we know it breaks the low energies. But if it's a discrete gauge symmetry, I don't see why you can't just say that.
Well, in years of reformulation, again, I mean, I don't remember these papers either, but in his reformulation, theta was the result of spontaneous breaking.
I mean, in some sense, also in any of the parity-based models, the theta is also a result of spontaneous breaking, because it's zero, and then you spontaneously break parity, and then it's set to non-zero. Yeah, but I mean, in some sense, theta is sort of a super selection thing. You set it and then forget it, and so you don't really have any preference to setting it from one thing or another. It could have just been accidentally set small. Well, and in the standard model, it would stay small, unfortunately.
No,
but
you
have
any new physics. You could add, but things are not really good.
Because that's, thank Anton again, it's easier for